Mandingo Lamont Haywood versus the Commonwealth of Virginia. I take it both of you had an opportunity to sign the sign-in sheets?
Yes, sir.
All right. You're a veteran now, so you know the whole spiel about the clock.
Yes, sir.
How much time would you like to reserve for rebuttal?
3 minutes, if I could.
Whenever you're ready to begin.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Samantha Offa Thames. I'm an assistant public defender at the Richmond office, and I'm here on behalf of Mandingo Haywood in his appeal. In this case, the officers did not have probable cause to arrest Mr. Haywood, and therefore the subsequent search of his person was unlawful, and the evidence found his person should have been suppressed. Mr. Haywood was, in fact, arrested on the scene. An arrest occurs when an officer physically restrains the suspect or the suspect submits to the officer's assertion of authority.
On the first assignment of error, the argument does seem to be that probable cause to search and probable cause to arrest are separate standards.
Yes, sir.
Where was that specific argument made below? Because the thrust of the argument at the suppression hearing, and clearly the only thing the trial judge actually explicitly ruled on was whether the drug dog was reliable. So in either...
Yes, sir.
Where is the best place for me to look to see that probable cause to arrest is different than probable cause to search?
As far as that goes, Your Honor, I would say that the Joint Appendix, page 3, explicitly preserves these particular facts and arguments for appeal. I don't know specifically if the trial counsel went into probable cause to arrest versus probable cause to search, but in that, she did specifically state that the officer searched Mr. Haywood on the scene, did not recover anything, and then unlawfully took him into custody and conducted an unlawful search after a false positive, and they found no drugs on him or on his person or in the car.
Would you agree that being in police custody is not synonymous with being arrested?
I would, but I think in this case he was arrested, Your Honor.
Okay, but the only line in that you're referring to in the motion to suppress... The written motion to suppress is that he was unlawfully taken into custody. If custody and arrest are distinct concepts, as you concede that they are, case law dictates that you have to concede that, then how is an argument that they didn't have reason to arrest him covered by he was unlawfully taken into custody when custody does not equal arrest?
In this case, I do think that does preserve the essential arguments to this, Your Honor. I do understand the court's point. However, the written motion was explicit that they did not find anything on his person and therefore unlawfully continued to search him after taking him to custody. And I do understand the court's point, but that is the preservation in this case.
Was he in custody when they stopped the car?
I would argue yes, that he was in custody at that point. He submitted to their request, and I think even the officer testified that he was not free to leave at that point.
Okay.
And I do think he was arguably arrested.
But there's no argument that the actual seizure... Mm-hmm. That putting him in the custody when the car was pulled over violated the Fourth Amendment. That was a totally legitimate seizure.
No, Your Honor. It was based off of just the frame of the license plate covering up part of Virginia and part of the stickers. So at that point, they did stop to investigate, and they collected IDs, and the drug dog arrived. So at that point, I do think that they were stopped at the very least, and I don't think that they could have left because the IDs were in possession of the officers.
Okay. So he was lawfully seized?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And at that point, Your Honor, the drug dogs did arrive. The drug dog ran on or, you know, went around the car and certainly also Mr. Haywood's person. The video is pretty clear that the dog officer says, it's either in the car or it's on him. They go through the car, they don't find anything. They search Mr. Haywood on scene, they don't find anything. He is then taken into full custody. He is read Miranda in the car, he's under arrest. And then they conduct another search on him in custody. There is no basis for the arrest in this case because they did in fact search Mr. Haywood on scene after the drug dog alerted, and they found nothing. It's pretty clear they went into his pockets, they went into his waistband, they stuck his hands in his pants, and they didn't find anything.
We don't have any type of Rodriguez elongation issue though here, correct?
I don't believe so because the officer still had their IDs when the drug dog arrived. I believe the officer testified it was approximately 7 minutes. I still believe they were still running their information on their computers in the car at that point. But simply in this case, what we have is an arrest based solely off of a drug dog sniff. which this court has never supported in its case law.
Regarding probable cause to search versus mm-hmm. probable cause to arrest and whether they're different standards, mm-hmm. it may depend on the type of crime. For me to have probable cause to search yes, somebody with on the suspicion of drugs, I have to have a reasonable belief mm-hmm. that they are in possession of illegal drugs, correct?
Yes, sir.
If I have a reasonable belief that somebody is in possession of illegal drugs, that's good enough, that equates to probable cause to search them. What would be different about the probable cause standard to arrest them for possession of the illegal drugs? Wouldn't I have to have the same, isn't the standard effectively the same, that I have to have a reasonable belief that based on objective information that he is in possession of illegal drugs? I mean, what would the difference be?
I would argue the difference, Your Honor, is that when we look at probable cause of search, the officers have to reasonably believe there's enough evidence for them, enough information present for them to find additional evidence at that point because of their search, versus probable cause to arrest, where they have to believe that they have enough evidence at that point to take someone into custody without further judicial review. I do think there are two different standards. I do understand the court's point is that the possession is the crime. However, in this particular circumstances, we also have a search where they didn't find anything, followed by an arrest. So I do think that there is a distinction in this particular case as well, because they did, short of stripping Mr. Haywood on the side of the road, it's hard to understand how much more they could have done to search him. They went into his pockets, they went into his pants. So there was a search where nothing was found on him. And then they put forward to arrest him based just off the drug dog alert, which was at that point proven to be unreliable because they did not find anything.
Well, is it unreliable, or that perhaps the search just wasn't as thorough as it could have been or should have been? Because I know we're not allowed to bootstrap with what's ultimately found, but the drug dog was right.
Well, Your Honor, the drug dog also could have smelled old marijuana on him. It could have been a myriad of other things. And simply because the dog was ultimately correct, I don't think this court can look at that. Because at the end of the day, Fourth Amendment was to protect those who were also innocent, and you know, they might have been old marijuana smells.
Well, I understand we can't bootstrap backwards, yes. but I don't think you can say the dog was wrong because the dog wasn't wrong.
Well, I do think at that point, a reasonable officer, all they knew is that they searched the car, they searched Mr. Haywood, they did not find anything. So under the standard of a reasonable officer in this circumstance, right at that point, the dog was wrong. And they also have a conversation with Mr. Haywood on scene about smoking marijuana earlier on that day. So there are other reasons why, even if the court would say, yes, the dog was correct, the dog could have smelled old marijuana, not necessarily any drugs on his person. So a reasonable officer, right at that point, should not have arrested Mr. Haywood. That should have been the end of the confrontation. Similarly, if an officer themselves were to smell marijuana in a car, search and find absolutely nothing in the car or on their person, they can't then just arrest them for that. So I'd argue, Your Honor, that at this point, the arrest was unlawful because there's no reasonable suspicion for the officers to have arrested them. In this facts and circumstances, the officers received some sort of a phone call about the block. They saw a car. They followed the car. The officer was very clear. The only reason why they pulled that car over was because the license plate tag was blocking stickers on the tag. The frame was blocking stickers on the tag. There's no testimony that Mr. Haywood seemed nervous, seemed evasive, seemed as though he were hiding anything, and also there's no testimony that he was doing anything illegal himself at that point. So he was arrested based solely off of a drug dog sniff that was proved to be unreliable on the scene in this case. And this court's case law does not support that. There is some other case law in other states, State versus Gibson out in Idaho, where that court did say that a drug dog sniff alone is not enough to arrest a person, especially when
Has Idaho adopted the plain smell test?
I'm not sure, Your Honor, but in this case, there was the plain smell. I think the plain smell doctrine is a little bit different because plain smell would be a police officer who smells marijuana versus the dog. I think it's a little different.
Well, given that the whole point of the plain smell doctrine is smells are emanating out mm-hmm. from you in a public place that you don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy in them, and therefore there is no search on plain smell, what difference does it make that it is a dog versus an officer who smells it? It's still in public. It's still emanating away from your person. yes, the dog is more likely to smell it, but the concept of plain smell is you don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy in odors that emanate from you out into the public.
Certainly, Your Honor, you don't. But in this case, a dog is a little different because it is a more nuanced tool that police use, I would argue. I also don't know if Idaho has adopted that standard, but I do think that our court has come relatively close with Whitehead versus Commonwealth, where in that case, the court has said that when the drug dog alerts on the car and you don't find anything, and it's particularized to the car, you can't then search the people. And I think that's analogous on some part to where Idaho was going, where if you search, have an alert, you can't just arrest someone because you don't find something in the car.
But there is testimony that the dog alerted on Mr. Haywood.
I would also, yes, Your Honor, but also point out that in the video, it's also pretty clear the officer says it's either on him or it's in the car. So while she testified clearly at motion to suppress and on the actual scene, it was more equivocal than that. It also leads me in part to my second assignment of error, that this dog was not reliable in this case. She did not sit as she was trained to do so. There was a long conversation.
What is the evidence of that? Because there seemed to be a lot of suggestion and premises in questions that the officer was asked that the dog did not respond appropriately, and this should have indicated that it wasn't a true alert. And the officer seemed to reject every one of those premises and said, no, this was a legitimate alert. The questions of counsel, even if the premises in them are correct, are not evidence. So what is the evidence that the dog did not properly alert?
The video is pretty clear that she only sits for a couple of seconds, Your Honor, and the officer did testify that those dogs are trained to sit. And the officer also said in her testimony that the dog sat for, I think, approximately 2 seconds. She also testified that the dog barely, I would say, did what she was trained to do, and then they moved on. She was pulled off by the officer. I do think the officer expressly testified to that.
But the officer unequivocally testified that the actions of the dog were consistent with an alert, consistent with the dog's training.
Yes, I believe that she also testified that the dog acted the way that she expected the dog to act, but that in still in the same circumstances, the dog was barely given a chance to indicate as she was trained, and I think she was explicit in that. Moreover, Your Honor, again, this dog was proved to be unreliable in this circumstance as well, based off my prior argument that they searched Mr. Haywood on scene, they didn't find anything.
But as far as the dog's history and the officer's testimony regarding purpose certifications, isn't that traditionally what we talk about when we're trying to establish the reliability of the drug dog, and hasn't that been held to be sufficient?
I would say that, sure, perhaps typically it is, goes down to the dog's records, and that wasn't contested in this case. But I do still think that in this case, even perfect people can be wrong, a perfect dog could be wrong, and this dog proved herself to be unreliable in this case at the point where the Fourth Amendment calls into question whether or not the officer should have relied on that. Moreover, Your Honor,
you're into your rebuttal. Yes. You may use it however you wish.
Thank you, Your Honor. I will reserve our rebuttal for my third argument, I assume. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. I am John Jones on behalf of the Commonwealth, and we are asking that the court would affirm Mr. Haywood's conviction pursuant to his conditional guilty plea because all three of his assignments of error are meritless and do not entitle him to relief. So on the first, there was abundant probable cause to arrest. This idea of, well, first off, on the preservation issue, I think that the court expressed concern that the specific argument that probable cause to search versus probable cause to arrest in this context are different things was never presented to the trial court, and just a general argument that the arrest was not supported by probable cause is not enough to preserve this specific argument, especially where if you look at the language that's used in the written suppression motion and what was raised there, you see that on page 3, the entire basis of the challenge is the reliability of the dog and the reliability of the alert. In the last sentence of the first paragraph on page 4, it says, therefore, no probable cause was present which authorized officers to take Mr. Haywood into custody for a full search. So that therefore links back to the arguments about Sarah's reliability It certainly doesn't raise the distinct legal argument that that probable cause to search and probable cause to arrest are different. And so,
what about the argument both made at the podium and in Mr. Haywood's reply brief that the sentence at the after the first paragraph after the number paragraphs, it's on the bottom of page 3. The officers unlawfully took Mr. Haywood into custody and conducted an unlawful search. Why doesn't that preserve the probable cause to arrest is not probable cause to search?
Because that's just a thesis that she then goes on, or that Mr. Haywood goes on to flesh out in the form of the reliability challenge. And so there's never introduced to the trial court this specific argument that probable cause to search and probable cause to arrest are different. Just saying that there wasn't probable cause. I think it's Edwards that talks about not putting a different cast on the arguments and that related arguments don't preserve, like a related argument doesn't preserve a distinct argument. These are distinct arguments. And I think that it is important because it's not just a procedural trap or gamesmanship at this stage. It really helps to ensure that the trial court has a full opportunity to rule on these issues and ensures that that unnecessary reversals and waste of judicial resources are not engaged in. I mean, if you just look at the entire argument that went on at the suppression hearing and in the context of this motion to suppress, it's clear that this was never presented face up to the trial court. The trial court didn't understand that this argument was being presented to it, you know, charitably, assuming that they intended to. It was never presented face up to the trial court in a way that it could intelligently rule on it. And so I think that the purposes of the contemporaneous of preservation rules in a 5A18 would be served, and I think that it's also the narrowest and best grounds on which to dispose of that particular argument. But if the court is inclined to reach the merits, there was abundant probable cause to arrest. And the idea that probable cause to arrest and probable cause to search are different, and that probable cause to arrest is somehow elevated, or that a dog sniff can give you one but not another, I think misconceives of what probable cause is. Probable cause is a level of justified certainty or confidence that attaches to specific facts. And those two pieces together can give you probable cause to search, can give you probable cause to arrest, can give you probable cause to do both, depending on what you're talking about. So here, we're talking about probable cause to believe that Mandingo Haywood had drugs on his person. And that is both probable cause to search to find those drugs, that evidence of contraband would be found on his person, and probable cause to believe that he is then committing a crime because possessing narcotics is a crime.
The officer in this court on review has to consider the totality of the evidence. Objectively, after the initial physical search doesn't reveal contraband, the search on the scene doesn't reveal contraband, what does that do to the probable cause calculation to arrest?
I don't think that it dispels. I'll get rid of the I don't think. It does not dispel probable cause. Those officers that performed that preliminary search knew how thoroughly they had searched. They knew where they had not searched. And they still decided to bring him into the station and ultimately did a full search and found the drugs. Now, I think that you have to give those reasonable inferences to the Commonwealth as the prevailing party below, and the officers. And, you know, probable cause is viewed through the eyes of a reasonable officer with the knowledge and experience that the officer on the scene would have been expected to have, and it's a common sense, flexible standard to say that if they perform any kind of initial screening, that don't find anything, that negates a very strong alert. And if you read through Officer Robinson's testimony about how Sarah behaves when she gets a narcotics odor and about how she was behaving in this particular sweep, this is a strong alert. And from a very well-trained dog who had never failed a certification exam, never even gotten one wrong, like a wrong response in a certification exam over several years, and an eminently qualified trainer, you know, she knew what she was looking at, and she testified to it before the trial court. There was abundant evidence for the trial court to credit both Robinson's testimony about what happened and how she perceived it, and Sarah, that to determine that Sarah's alert was in fact reliable and that the officers were justified in relying on it. Does that answer your question? Okay. So, in the totality of the evidence, you know, and I think that it's important to note also that just from a policy perspective, that you cannot, I mean, you could, but it would be unwise, I think, to give officers an option between if they have probable cause to arrest, either doing no initial search or doing a full-blown strip search, and you got to choose one of those. And that's the practical impact, I think, of adopting Haywood's argument on this point, that if you do any initial search, you got to do the whole thing or just not arrest them if you don't find anything. And that's just not a workable standard, and it would go against, I think, the spirit of or just the nature of probable cause as a common sense standard that it is. On the second assignment of error, I've probably already touched on some of this with just talking about the evidence that was before the trial court from Robinson's testimony and from Sarah's previous certification results that were introduced into evidence, that there was abundant evidence upon which the trial court could rely in crediting that testimony and finding that there was probable cause. The reliability question, it largely hinges on factual questions, and the trial court, you know, is entitled to a lot of deference on those, and it clearly credited Robinson's testimony, and so there's no basis to reverse on that second assignment of error. Robinson testified unequivocally that there's no minimum time that Sarah would have to do her trained response of sitting to qualify as a full performance of her alert or whatever. On page 74 and 75 of the appendix is where that testimony is. She also testified that the response doesn't matter, that the trained response of sitting just doesn't matter, that what the trainers are trained to look for is the alert behaviors. And with Sarah, it's of getting rigid and wanting to get to the source of the scent and these things that she testified about. Throughout the 40s and 50s of the appendix, but on 51 and 52, I believe, is the portion of her testimony where she says flat out that it's nice and dandy if they do the trained response, but what we look for is the alert behavior, and she did that in spades in this particular situation. And so the trial court was certainly entitled to reject sort of the implication that was introduced through cross-examination that
the search that was done on the scene, is it best characterized as a full-on search or a pat-down?
I think that it probably went beyond what we think of as a pat-down, but I think that it is in that species of initial frisk and initial preliminary search. Clearly, they didn't intend it as a full search, or they would have turned him loose. I think, you know, I don't think that we can presume otherwise here. Because they didn't find anything in that initial frisk, search, whatever you want to call it. Certainly, I think it would fit into the Terry species of initial investigatory search, I guess, if that makes sense. Does that answer your question, Your Honor?
It does.
Okay. So, I cited the Beasley case in my brief, and it talks about how officers' observations, as they are informed by their unique training and experience, can support probable cause, even if the facts that they're noticing are things that would elude an untrained observer. And I think that that's a lot of what we have here with Robinson's testimony of how she interpreted Sarah's behavior is important, and it was credited by the trial court. And so there's really no basis by which to shoehorn these other attacks on the reliability that have come up, and some of them never came up at trial, talking about the old marijuana odors. I mean, there is support for that argument potentially in the video, but it was never presented to the trial court. That's a serious 5A18 problem, I think, for that particular argument, and there are others that I cover in the brief. So If the court doesn't have any other specific questions on assignment of error 2, though, I would move on and talk a little bit about assignment of error 3. So there are a couple of procedural bars to reaching assignment of error 3, I believe. The first one is that this was a conditional guilty plea, and that's important because you have to specify exactly what rulings or ruling of the trial court you are intend to appeal in order to reserve that right. He conceded his guilt through his guilty plea, but reserved the right to appeal the trial court's denial of his motion to suppress, all capitalized. I think that's important in this as well. I lay out the reasons fully in the brief, but I just mentioned that the capitalization in the conditional guilty plea indicates a proper noun. I think it refers to the written motion.
But at the argument that the trial court was had at the hearing.
Yes, sir.
Reference was made to the dogs essentially invading the personal space.
Yes, Your Honor.
And how close the dog got to him. Why isn't that sufficient to preserve it?
I think under 5A18 it probably would preserve it because that argument was presented to the trial court. This is sort of a distinct problem that they reserved a very specific right to appeal, and it was what was contained in that motion to suppress evidence capitalized. And the other
if it hadn't been capitalized, would it be preserved?
Preservation, I don't think, is the way that I would put it. I think it's a separate procedural bar.
My question, because you seem to be saying because it was capitalized, that has to only refer to the written motion. Well, then I would take it that the converse of that is, if it's not capitalized, it covers both the written motion and the argument.
I think that Mr. Haywood's would have a better place from which to argue that it was preserved.
Well, if your capitalization argument works, why wouldn't he not just have a better argument? Why would he not have a winning argument?
Because there's another factor in that it is it said heard and denied on the date of the suppression hearing, and you see in that exchange between counsel and the court. Is it denied the substance of the written motion and refused to rule twice on the argument that Sarah's sniff was itself a search.
Your statement that it refused to rule, is that an implicit refusal, or did he specifically say, "I'm not touching that"?
He said, "I'm not touching that." I mean, I can give you appendix sites about that. They're also referenced in my brief. But I quote the entire exchange, and I do think that it's important. I recognize it's a technical argument. It's not my only argument. But I think that it is strong. I do think that, you know, courts treat conditional guilty pleas with a whole lot of precision to make sure that they don't sort of trick the Commonwealth into allowing them to appeal a bunch of additional things that they didn't reserve face up below. And a guilty plea generally waives all defenses if you know that you don't specifically reserve. And so I think it's inappropriate to. The other thing is that the trial court didn't make a ruling on this, and there was a basis for it to refuse to rule because suppression motions have to be put. I see that I'm running out of time, so if the court has any additional questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Otherwise, I would just ask that you would affirm and refer you to my brief for the remainder of my.
Thank you, Mr. Jones.
Thank you.
Ms. Thames.
Yes, Your Honor. The trial court here did make a ruling. It rejected the entire motion to suppress. That was clear. The back and forth between Ms. Rosenblatt and the court was more directed towards whether or not the court needed to go through every single part of her argument and make a ruling. The court was clear that it did not believe it had to do that. It made its ruling. It had denied the motion to suppress, both as in writing and as orally argued. There is no objection from the Commonwealth for her to have gone into this that the AG is now saying is not preserved, is not part of her written motion. There's absolutely no objection from the Commonwealth about that. The court did not stop her from making these arguments. The court heard both, received both, the court denied both. The court clearly made a ruling, and that ruling was the motion to suppress was denied. For the conditional guilty plea, for capitalization to determine constitutional rights seems a little bit beyond the fold here. It was clear that the conditional guilty plea encompassed the motion to suppress and that there is a clause in there heard on May 22nd and denied by the court. That encompasses both. The trial court speaks through its orders. The trial court did not limit anything. The trial court kept it both to just the motion to suppress, which was submitted to the court in writing, and heard by the court at oral arguments. So for those reasons, Your Honor, third assignment error is preserved. And generally speaking, we would still maintain that, the dog coming that close to Mr. Haywood does amount to a search, and at that point there is no reason, no basis for a dog to have been allowed to do that, because there is simply nothing Mr. Haywood was doing up to that point would be remotely considered to be illegal. And as far as the first argument goes towards this, this was a search, Your Honor. This was not a Terry pat-down. He went into the pockets. They put their hands in his pants. This was a full-blown search. And it was a bad search because the drugs were ultimately found in his pants. So it pales to consider how much more they could have done. They should have let him go at that point. They did a search. They found nothing. They went forward based solely off a drug dog sniff. And for that to keep going forward, does a drug dog sniff then allow them to strip search, take someone down to the hospital, and do further searches? That's what this court would be saying if it allows for a drug dog sniff to allow them to jump past a clear search into arrest with further further searches. And in this case, this simply was, and this was not a strong alert also, Your Honor. The video is very clear. The dog could either have been indicating towards the truck or Mr. Haywood. So for those reasons, Your Honor, we ask that the court rule in Mr. Haywood's favor on all three assignments of error.
Thank you very much. We'll come down and greet counsel.